This is coming from Blue Hearts. You have to look at all of our services. Please join us.
Good evening, welcome to the... Tonight we're going to talk for 1 hour about many different things that happen around the internet. My name is Chris Kay, and first off in this show we were going to talk about data love. We're going to talk to Tomate and Lotte from Berlin, who have engaged in this project called datalove.me. Then we shift over to Australia, where Jay Walk and Mudkip are going to talk about animals. We will hear stories about the kangaroo eunuchs, the wind bats, and the water rat duckies. Then we will talk a little bit about computer security. So me and the doctor will talk about how journalists and everyday internet users can secure their communications and how we can adapt these tools. So stay tuned to and we will have a fun hour. Hello and welcome. Today we are going to talk to Tomate and Lotte in Berlin. They have recently launched a very cool project called datalove.me. And can you guys tell me what it's about?
Hello? Yeah, the datalove.me project. When I started working with Telecomics, with the people there, I often got the term datalove. And I had really problems understanding for myself what this is and what it's all about. So I read through the interfaces where some approaches on what is data love are inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't enough for me.
Okay.
It was too difficult for me. And then I started to write it down with other Telecomics agents, the principles of data love,
mm-hmm.
which are well known by now, hopefully. And yeah, then we had these principles, but it was not enough.
Okay.
This was the point where I thought about an own website for it. This is the point where Lotte drops in, because I needed someone for design.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, there was kind of a more or less desperate call on Twitter that he's looking forward to having a t-shirt. And I asked, do you actually have a t-shirt designer? And that was the point where I assigned myself to making a t-shirt. And I started to contribute to this project because when the whole thing in Egypt happened, I was really just glued to the screen and to Twitter and trying to find out what happened. And I admired the whole Telecomics work, but I didn't know how to help the project, because I didn't have the skills and because everything went so quickly. But all the ideas that I thought were transpired or were inspired by the Telecomics work were summed up in this data love manifesto in the end, and I wanted to help to spread this manifesto further than just the revolution and to make it last. And yes, that's Data Lock for me.
Okay, that's interesting, because I mean, this concept has been around for a while. In the 1970s, Kraftwerk recorded this song called Computer Liebe. Computer Love. And my impression is that this is kind of a sad story if you listen to the lyrics. It's about this guy sitting home alone one night, and he's going online on this pre-internet kind of computer network and looking for a rendezvous, somebody to meet up with in the lonely night. So how is, if we compare this concept of computer Liebe with data love, is there a difference or is it basically the same thing?
Oh, there's a difference. Basically, data love is all about communication, because when I'm talking to someone, this is data too. And we do not want that anyone is interrupted in his communication.
Mm-hmm.
So what Kraftwerk did was this geek alone at home for his computer.
And a number of other songs that describe it. Yes.
Yeah. And we're going in a way where it's all about communications.
Yeah. So, but still, I mean, I'm thinking, it's, love is a human affect, and it's something that we long for, and something that, so I think that there is this kind of connecting people is something that is a ground for love. But, data love is a concept that is against censorship, for example. It's very much an abstract concept. But I think that also kind of the telecomics experience is about data love, because it's all about friendship in one sense.
Yeah, of course. Friendship is a very important thing behind that. And even more than friendship, but deep feelings for people. And all this can only happen if you're able to communicate, if you're able to change data.
Mm-hmm.
Exchange data.
Yeah, exchange, sorry.
So what will be the future of datalove.me? What's the kind of, what will happen in the future?
Oh, many things.
Awesomeness.
Awesomeness, of course.
Yeah, what we're actually we don't know the future of datalove.me, because datalove and .me lives with its contributors, and it's not us who guide datalove.me. It's actually what everybody makes of it, what everybody who wants to contribute does to this site. So if you have any ideas, may it be an offline activity, for example, I did a very girly thing, I baked datalove cupcakes. And I will put the recipe online later on. Or may it be an online activity. Maybe, I don't know, you program a little data love flash game, or you do anything. You do ASCII art. You do tattoo art. Whatever you do with it, we will put it on the site, and you will be a part of it as soon as you think about data love.
Yeah, or at least we have the wiki from Rebuild. Yeah. Everybody can contribute, and the first people did things, ASCII art, a song. Okay, it's not that good, but someone did a song. Okay. That's great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And he actually put it on online as a remix package, if I'm right.
Yeah.
And that's the awesome thing about it. The Data Love logo actually just started because I started out with some scribbles and sent them to a friend of ours, who then just compiled it into the ultimate awesome Data Love logo. And maybe somebody will take this song and be like, hey, this is actually a pretty good idea, and I can maybe take it a step further and share the Data Love by putting my own input into it. And that's really, really fascinating and amazing about it.
Yeah, it's a living of copy, remix, and share.
Yeah.
The little buttons on the side, we got them one day after we launched the site, and by mail, just, hey, here's some buttons, use them.
That's cool, yeah. So in one sense, copyright is not data love. I mean, copyright is something that prevents you from sharing data, isn't it?
Yeah, copyright is not data love.
Okay.
So it's, of course, a very liberal concept.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just put in words what many people think about mm-hmm. data and art and music and texts. So it may be just another step into a better society of art.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
It can be one approach.
Okay, so, but in many respects, this is also similar to the project launched by the Pirate Bureau a few years ago, the Copy Me project. Copy Me is also kind of a principle or something that says that, well, copy me. This is kind of an act of love that you copy and share and kind of spread the word about this thing, whether it's a picture or a music file or a video file or whatever it is.
Yeah, but copy is a one-by-one copy. It was too narrow for myself. And the data love thing is about copying and remixing and living it. So what I can think about is a big data love picnic in a park. So you bring some Wi-Fi hotspots and sit together and picnic and share data and communicate to people you might only have met online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a step further in my thought. The Copimi project is very important for the whole copyright thing, but the data love thing is more going to communication.
Yes.
So data love can also be like offline, an offline event.
Yeah, totally.
Please.
Imagine a summer of data love.
That's cool.
And that doesn't just mean typing ASCII art hearts into a, I don't know, into some IRC channel, that which is awesome as well. but you can also, I love meeting people I have met online in, as they say, real life.
Yeah.
Although online is real life to me too, but well, and the idea is to share that love in many, many ways. And as I said, in offline and online actions. And really anything you can think of.
Yeah, or a big data love party.
Yeah.
Bring your music.
We'll throw that in Berlin, I promise.
We will.
Yeah. I definitely agree, and I think that Berlin is a perfect city. There are many very nice parks there, and Berlin is a great city. And actually, to give it a little bit of a Telecomics history, actually Telecomics was kind of founded or started up in a party in Gothenburg. So it started off offline, really, and. Well, you know, people and friends, we got together and we had a few beers, and then we said, let's do something about politics and internet and whatever. And somebody just came up with the name, Telecomics, like, because it sounds cool. So I think that these kinds of meetings and these kinds of, you know, offline activities are extremely important to bridge this kind of digital hallucination of, you know, me sitting here in Gothenburg and you're sitting in Berlin and we're just, you know, talking over the networks. This is extremely important and it's extremely revolutionary, but I think that these offline meetings are as important.
Yes, absolutely. And the Data Love Project wants to bring these online friendships and the trust we have online to other people. to the offline world.
Yeah, of course.
It is somehow weird, but I trust sometimes more in the people I have online than offline. And this is way weird. Because
yeah.
I know them better than the offline people.
Sometimes you do. And, you know, sometimes if you wake up from a terrible nightmare in the middle of the night, you can just go online and there's always somebody on the internet, even if you're all alone. So it's a very good way of knowing that the world is still there. This sounds very strange, I know. But
No. That's it.
Okay. So, thank you for telling the world about the Data Love project. And to go to this website, you go to datalove.me.
Yeah, and follow Data Love Summer on the Twitters.
Oh, yeah. Data Love Summer on Twitter. Okay, so thanks for being on the Telecomics radio show.
No problem. You're welcome.
Okay.
Hi. So, we've been asked to add something about wind animals to the show. My name is Jaywalk, and
I'm Mudcat.
And we're both currently in Australia, and this is a land full of wind animals.
Yeah, we didn't really know how to structure the whole thing, so we just did a bunch of research on interesting facts and animals that you don't see anywhere else in the world, pretty much, and killer animals, because we all like killer animals. I think the most interesting thing that we saw at the zoo was probably the platypus.
Yeah, the platypus, or water rat ducky, as I named it now.
This wasn't really a representative one, was it?
I think it was. I've only seen one platypus in my life, and
First thing we should probably say about the platypus is that it's pretty small. It's only like, how big would you say it is? Like
body maybe 60, 70 centimeters.
Yeah, but I was expecting, I don't know, maybe it's because I'd only ever seen it in pictures or something, I was expecting it to be like a meter long, like a huge animal.
Ah, well, it's kind of like a beaver, I think.
A small little one, and it swims.
Yeah, and it has a beak like a duck.
And here's one of our facts. Apparently, the platypus is so weird that when they brought the first, I think, dead body, is it? Do they bring dead bodies?
I think
back?
It was dead
body,
yeah.
They brought the dead body back to the UK, and everyone thought that they were trolling them, basically, by sewing a duck bill onto some kind of animal, like, I don't know, a beaver or something. But yeah, they thought that they were being trolled.
Yeah, and by a Virginia legend, the first platypus, or the first two, were created by a water rat mating with a duck. So everyone seems to think it's some kind of messed up fraud or freak of nature.
Yeah.
But anyway, they're really cool animals, and they always go in small circles, counterclockwise. And that's what we learned at the zoo.
I think something was wrong with that platypus, though. Like, maybe he'd been in a confined space by himself for an extended period of time, and not... Maybe this had manifested itself as some kind of mental disorder, because he was just swimming in, like... Probably the diameter of the circle was, like... 30 centimeters? He was just going round and round and round. But the interesting thing about platypuses is that they don't open their eyes or ears underwater. and their beak, their bill, has electroreceptors that they use to detect electrical impulses given off by insects and all the other gross stuff that they eat, which they find in the mud. And their monotremes, they are one of two monotremes in the world. The other one is the wombat.
Is it?
Yeah, oh, I think cool. So.
That's awesome. I didn't
which
know
means that they're mammals that lay eggs.
Ah, right. Yeah, that's probably true. Anyway, that's a good time to move over to the wombat, or windbat, as I would like to call it.
We saw one of those too in Wilson's promontory.
Yeah, we saw it in the wild eating from the ground. Probably
eating from the ground.
Yes,
eating grass.
Their table manners are terrible.
It was so cute. We were driving along, and I think it's the case, like, when you're in national parks and you see cars stopped at the side of the road, you can be pretty sure that they've seen some kind of animal. And so it was just this brown thing in the middle of the road. It looked, well, like a wombat, I'm not going to lie. we were all standing around taking photos of it and following it into the bush. And it was really cute. It was adorable. Yeah.
The face looks kind of like a koala, but it's big, brown, and round, and apparently quite heavy.
But they're, like, really dangerous.
Yeah, apparently they're really dangerous, and if I knew that, maybe I wouldn't have walked so close with my camera, but I'm alright.
They're fearless, I think, but you don't think that when you see it, and I think Ludin's got a picture of a wombat being picked up, and it just looked so cute. It looked like a baby. But they're really bad, because apparently some guy, here's my fact, on 6th of April 2010, a 59-year-old man from rural Victoria was mauled by a wombat, thought to have been angered by mange, which is this disgusting fur thing virus falls off and makes it look horrible, causing a number of cuts and bite marks requiring hospital treatment, and he resorted to killing it with an axe. Would you like to kill a wombat with an axe?
I would not like to kill a wombat with an axe.
Yeah.
And apparently they have short legs, they're big, round, and fluffy, so they look like calm and slow animals, but apparently they can run extremely quickly. They can
40 kilometers an hour, and I'm a pretty, you know, I'm a very, let's say that I like to think I run faster than the wind. And I calculated my top speed for 400 meters, which was like 25 kilometers an hour. And a wombat can run faster than me.
Yeah, I actually checked. They can run in 40 kilometers an hour for about 90 seconds, which makes them actually beat the world record for humans for a kilometer sprint.
Who does a kilometer sprint?
Of course they do kilometer sprints. I mean, you have 100 meters, 400 meters.
For a kilometer?
The human record is about, I think it was 131 seconds, and a wombat would, with its top speed, do that in 90 seconds.
Do you want a fun fact for your life? Humans who accidentally find themselves in an affray with a wombat might find it best to scale a tree until the animal calms and leaves. Humans can receive puncture wounds from a wombat claws as well as bites. And startled wombats can also charge humans and bowl them over, with the attendant risks of broken bones from the fall. And they've got like something on their backside, like hard, so that when they're digging a hole, a dingo can't attack them.
Yeah, right. They actually, if some animal tries to attack or eat them and enters their tunnels, they're actually known to crush the skull of the other animal by just raising their legs.
And sometimes they trick them. This is this fact that I tell everyone, and no one really listens to me, but now you have no choice. So basically, if a dingo or something wants to go into a wombat tunnel, sometimes the wombat will let the dingo walk over his back, thinking it's the ground, and then he'll stand up and he'll crush them against the ceiling.
Exactly.
Isn't that cool? That's cool.
Yeah, and if they don't want to, mean they just stop the entrance with their behind.
Or they crush them on the ceiling.
Yeah, whichever. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so let's. We've talked plenty about wombats and platypus, but let's move on to, I guess, the most famous Australian animal, like national symbol almost.
Do you know why it's on the national symbol? Kangaroos and I think emus, I can't remember, it's here somewhere and I'll probably correct myself later, but they're on the national crest because they can't Oh no, echidnas. Kangaroos and echidnas cannot walk backwards, and this is considered symbolic, and so they put them on the national crest.
Ah, all right.
Mm.
Yeah, but we have seen plenty of kangaroos out in the wild here, and yeah, they're just as cool as you could imagine. And some of them are really big.
Yeah,
I was a bit surprised.
Then if you hit one with your car, you'd probably need to be worrying about your car and not the kangaroo, which is what surprised me when I first moved here.
Yeah, it sounds about like the Swedish moose as the road accident thing.
Yeah.
But do you not say anything specific about kangaroos? Or?
Yes, I do. Okay. Firstly, they're born and they're 2 centimeters at birth. But what I really wanted to tell you was that a kangaroo being chased by a dog may jump into a dam, and if the dog gives chase, the kangaroo may turn towards the dog, then use its paws to push the dog's head underwater to drown it.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's, not what I was expecting, but, similar, what I actually thought was kangaroos at first, was apparently wallabies, which I recognized the name, but I didn't even know they existed. But they're wannabes anyway. They're smaller than kangaroos and mostly run around in forests instead of the plains.
Yeah, they
but,
run around.
They
the
look
forest.
Very similar, I think.
Yeah, they're a lot smaller, but otherwise, yeah, they're pretty similar. But there's one wallaby that I read about, the purple-necked wallaby that secretes a dye that transforms its face and neck into colours ranging from light pink to bright purple.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
We've got a lot of animals here. Let's pick one that's really interesting.
I think jellyfish are always interesting, but maybe that's just me.
You seem to be scared of jellyfish when we were at the beach.
I am scared of jellyfish, but that doesn't mean I'm less amazed by them.
All right.
Yeah, so we picked out 2 of the dangerous Australian ones, and that's the box jellyfish.
Yeah.
And the Portuguese man-o-war, also known as the blue bottle.
The box jellyfish is the most venomous animal in the world, I think.
Yeah, I think it might be. And rare for jellyfishes that actually swims, it can actively move in water, instead of just floating around and hoping to hit something.
I know, at top speeds of 1.8 meters per second, and the average human swims at 2 meters per second, so...
Can we swim at 2 meters per second?
That
sounds fast.
That's what Yahoo Answers says.
Yeah. Oh, well. But yeah, box jellyfish can actually kill humans and are very dangerous. Man-o-wars aren't as dangerous, but they are just as cool, I think. They are very have a very, very particular look to them. I guess that's why they're called the blue bottle. One interesting thing I learned about the blue bottles was that there are octopus that are immune to their venom and which are known to rip off their tentacles and use them to defend themselves.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, but it's quite cool for animals. I mean, using tools or remaining even parts of other animals to
but
defend
you can't
themselves.
Sting a jellyfish with its own tentacles.
No, but it can defend it against other animals.
Oh.
Because it's one of the few that's immune to it.
Well, that was a good fact to go out on.
I think so too. So that's all for about the wind animals for now. We have plenty more to say if anyone wants to hear some other time. Okay, so that's thanks for us.
Now we will talk to the doctor, who is into security and communications, and we will talk about how to promote secure technologies to people who are not hackers, but people who are still in the need for secure technologies to communicate. So, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Could you elaborate a little bit about how to promote these kind of encryption technologies and technologies to circumvent surveillance and censorship that we use, that could be used and are extremely important to use in the situations that are unfolding today?
Sure. Okay. The way that I usually come about it is I don't throw a lot of technical jargon at people. I don't talk about cipher suites or how AES works or regional surveillance or anything like that. I make it personal. And the way I make it personal is what I say is, okay, everyone is using a public network, which is probably not secured. There's usually a couple of people in the room that are checking their email on their smartphone or their BlackBerry. There's always someone updating their Facebook page, stuff like that. And I tell them that anybody in this room could be monitoring your communications. I'm willing to bet that at least half the people are not using SSL or TLS encrypted links. And anybody could be recording their traffic, watching what they're doing, recording their usernames and passwords, and monitoring the content that they're browsing. And once that's been established, I tell them how to mitigate this. The way that you prevent someone from monitoring your communications, at least on your local network, is you use encryption. You always make sure that you're accessing the HTTPS URL with your web browser. If you're using a Twitter client, make sure that it's configured to contact a secure server. Sometimes it says SSL support, sometimes it says TLS support, sometimes it says secure support, or something of that, or something like that. Then the other thing I'd bring up is, just because you have encrypted your traffic on the network you're using right now, and thus your traffic is encrypted going out through the ISP to wherever the destination is, the destination may also be under surveillance. And a great way of, or a very timely way of explaining that is what happened with the Jasmine Revolution in China a couple weeks ago, which wound up not going off. Practically everybody involved got arrested. It may even have been a sting.
And
that is where I bring in technologies like Tor and Freenet. And I'm a Tor user first and foremost. I don't really use Freenet for anything, so my experience is limited, so I'm going to stick to that. I explain what Tor does. Again, I don't throw a lot of technical jargon at them. I explain what onion routing is and how Tor works and how onions going across the Tor network are encrypted sequentially and then decrypted sequentially. And I also describe how Tor middleman routers and how Tor exits are selected. And I also tell them up front that yes, Tor does slow your browsing down somewhat. It's kind of hit or miss depending on what nodes your connections are being routed through. You can't really do anything about that.
But
a lot has been done in the past year or so to really speed things up, and that's really good to see. A lot of people are getting active. A lot of code is being written to optimize how Tor works. It's actually been amazing watching it evolve in just a year's time.
And
once that's been established, okay, this is how your browser is configured to use Tor. This is what it does. This is how your connections are routed, etc., etc. Then I go into all of the ways that a determined attacker could pick out one user whose traffic is leaving a Tor exit node from everyone else. And that gets into browser fingerprinting and how unique web browsers are from computer to computer, from OS to OS, from revision of Java to revision of Java. And the Tor's Panopticlick research program was really instructive and also a little scary, because even if you've taken pains to configure your browser to look as generic as possible, it is still possible to get a fairly good fingerprint of someone's activity.
Mm-hmm.
And to get back to the main gist of this conversation, it isn't that trying to explain to people how this technology works the way a hacker knows it works turns them off on it. It sounds too complicated. It sounds shady. You're going back to using a 300 baud modem and dial up to call a BBS, and it's actually not the case. Something else that has to be done to get people more interested in applying privacy technologies in their everyday life is the sorts of people who use them every day and the sorts of people who need them. Human rights activists need it.
Yeah.
People who are politically active need it. Look at Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, what have you, as excellent examples of this.
Indeed. I think that so basically what you're saying is that showing people how insecure their lines are by default is a good way of opening up a kind of security thinking. That I think that there was this great kind of software called FireSheep that showed how easily your Facebook and Twitter sessions could be hijacked, and basically getting your login information and hijacking your account very easily. And we also saw this in Tunisia, where the government actually hijacked Facebook accounts by inserting a script, I think it was a JavaScript, inserting this into your browser at the level of the ISP, and kind of showing how important it is to consider using HTTPS, and also kind of making sure that the fingerprint for the site that you're accessing is actually the right fingerprint.
Absolutely. I think that FireSheep did an excellent job of bringing some awareness to these issues.
Indeed.
I don't know how much awareness it's brought. Among the security community, it was certainly a, yes, we know this happens, only we do it with protocol analyzers rather than a Firefox plugin.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it really brought it home for a lot of people. Your average person who goes to Starbucks before going to work every morning and checks their email on their smartphone, or who works out of a coffee shop for that matter and may have a couple of clients but isn't necessarily scrupulous about using SSL for email or for making sure that their VPN client has connected to where they think it would. Well, that's difficult, but I think you see what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I mean, indeed, I think that in Sweden it was even in the tabloids and in the evening news about FireSheep. It's like, but you know, it was like the headlines were, oh, they are, you know, hijacking your account. But I think that it really made an impact in bringing this awareness about, okay, so if you're on a public Wi-Fi, or if somebody can tune into your Wi-Fi, then you're in trouble. So I think that security sometimes comes. This is not maybe the best way of doing it, but sometimes the fear of being hijacked or the fear of being tuned into and monitored is actually a good way of bringing about this awareness.
Absolutely. Even if it gets people curious about it, curious enough to do a couple of Google searches and see what it's all about, it's still bringing awareness. It's getting people to think in terms of operational security. It's getting people to think in terms of what they're using, what threats are against it, or what threats are extant against what they're using, and the steps they can take to mitigate those threats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a common mode of thought for a lot of people, but it has to be to at least some extent if anything is going to change for the better.
Yeah. So I'm thinking from another perspective. Now we've been talking about how to bring this awareness to people, but then we have the other side, which is the developers and the programmers of these softwares. What do you think that that hackers and programmers and developers of these softwares can do to kind of to bridge the gap between something that is really, you know, high tech, very, you know, esoteric, maybe sometimes even hard to explain, and how to bridge the gap to the everyday user who is accustomed to, you know, just going online, going to Facebook, going to Google, and using the already installed applications in his or her computer. So what can we do from the other side, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I think that making connections secure by default is a great way to start. Mm-hmm. The EFF's Firefox add-on HTTPS Everywhere has done a remarkable job of that.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that we could do is we have to continue making things have same defaults on the back end and also put intuitive and useful user interfaces on the software we write.
Mm-hmm.
The Tor project has Vidalia, which does an excellent job of this.
Yeah.
And in fact, sort of brings everything in the Tor browser bundle together. It's an application that runs in your system tray. It has a menu. Everything is configured the same defaults. And the labels on the options are intuitive or approach intuitive for your average user.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes very far. Something else that I think we could do is we have to not sequester ourselves in our labs and in our hacker spaces and keep doing our thing, but we have to communicate with your average user and explain to them why this is important and explain to them the risks and the possible consequences of not mitigating those risks. Again, we can't do this with a lot of technical jargon. I mean, we can talk about onion routing and AES and symmetric ciphers and asymmetric ciphers till the cows come home. But if your mom doesn't understand it when you're sitting around after Thanksgiving dinner talking about this sort of thing, it doesn't make a difference. So what we have to do is we have to find ways of explaining how these technologies work and how they're applied without drowning people in three-letter acronyms and 50-cent words.
Indeed.
And that's actually not terribly difficult to do. It takes a little thought, and mm-hmm. you really have to think about it before you actually find yourself in a situation where you're advocating for these things.
Yeah.
But it's well worth the effort, and once you've got it down, all it takes is one remark to start a conversation, and then one conversation means that you're explaining to someone why privacy technologies are important and where they can be found and how they're used properly, and then they tell people about it, and their friends do research on it, and their friends find how-tos, or their friends talk to you. They take you aside in the hallway and they ask you about this, or it comes up over lunch or something.
Indeed, yeah.
And
yeah, because what I find difficult, and for example, Telecomics have been working a lot, like online, trying to, things were going down in Egypt, and 5 minutes later, there were Egyptians there asking, well, how can we, you know, circumvent these censorships, and how can we protect ourselves? And trying to explain that in 5 minutes over IRC, I mean, it's impossible in one sense. I think that one important aspect is to have this kind of security thinking and these knowledges being there before they are needed. I mean, you have to practice, you have to make mistakes, and then you can use them. So I think that this kind of general reaching out and spreading these knowledges before you actually need them is really important.
Absolutely. Part of it is you have to practice with these technologies to understand what you're seeing and make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. You can't be afraid to make mistakes, but you have to make your mistakes when it doesn't count. The folks in Egypt who were on IRC asking for advice and knew that change was in the air, most of them could not afford to forget to have Tor button clicked the first time they went to a particular website. You have to know what to look for. It has to become reflexive. And you also have to have the tools before you need them.
Yeah.
Once the network links going into and out of Egypt started going dark, there was getting hold of privacy technologies was extremely difficult. The only way it could really be gotten was from friend to friend on USB keys or CDs or DVDs. But if you didn't know anybody who was clued in beforehand, you would have a very difficult time of finding someone in all the turmoil.
Yeah.
And also, using privacy technologies in everyday life, you really have to work with them a little bit every day to understand how they work, to get used to the workflow of turning this on, opening my other browser, stuff like that.
Yeah.
A good friend of mine once said, you fight like you train. And that is most certainly the case.
Indeed. So I think that we should kind of, because this is what I do, and I send like all my emails to my friends, I send with the GPG and encryption, even though there is nothing secret in them and there is no need for it really. It's a good way of kind of establishing standards for communications that are secure by default, even if you don't need it. I mean, I try to avoid applications that are unencrypted. I use HTTPS everywhere to kind of do most of my browsing on encrypted connections. So I think that starting with your everyday life, making it more secure, is actually a good practice and a good kind of way of making security a default, not an exception. I mean, because all of these situations, when things go really bad in a country or wherever you are, when you really need it, then it's usually too late. So making these kind of technologies a part of your everyday life is actually the best way of making them being in the backbone of your online behavior.
Exactly. And I think that a worthwhile goal for us to push toward is not just to make security available and active by default, but to get people to expect things to be secure, to get them used to seeing HTTPS, to get them used to making sure that their mail client has the the SSL V3 TLS V1 checkbox checked, and to ask why it isn't when it's not. To go to their administrators and ask them, why aren't you doing this? Exactly. To stop and scratch their heads and say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. To see something come up, to see something happen when they're on an untrusted network and realize, wait a minute, somebody might be playing games here. I'd better stop doing what I'm doing and go somewhere else or double check to make sure my settings are correct.
Exactly. And we also need to demand this of our, you know, the big players in the field. So, I mean, like Facebook and Twitter, I mean, still the default is unencrypted traffic. And they do support HTTPS, but it's not the default, but we can still kind of, and it's used by millions of people who are actually in a very critical need for security. But I think that by kind of demanding these upgrades, because, I mean, these are private corporations. For them, it's expensive to, you know, do an upgrade. I've heard that there are a few extra CPU cycles in, you know, delivering HTTPS compared to HTTP. But still, I think that these demands are really important, and we have to demand it from the main players in online social media and so forth, because the traffic going on Facebook and Twitter is really so insecure, and it's so easy to use this traffic to, you can intercept it and you can map networks, social networks, so easily. So this traffic is actually the most valuable if you are out there to gather information. So it has to be protected.
It does, yes. And in fact, a couple of months ago, a small group of researchers at Google published a paper online in which they determined that it actually isn't computationally infeasible to run SSL by default. Mm-hmm. It does require a few more compute cycles per session, but not much. No. There's really no reason that most every service could not offer SSL by default, with the exception of maybe the shared service providers who charge at the nose for it.
Mm-hmm.
Call me crazy. I don't like the idea of paying an extra $15 a month just to have an SSL certificate, or just to be able to use an SSL certificate on my website.
Mm-hmm.
I find that unacceptable. It's almost highway robbery.
Yeah.
But until we start applying pressure, that's not going to change. And the way we apply pressure is we get the word out, we raise a stink about it, and then we threaten to take our money and our use elsewhere.
Exactly.
And once they realize that once a few people leave, a lot of people will leave, it'll start impacting their bottom line, and then maybe they'll think about offering these security options as part of the basic package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but because after all, I mean, these big players, such as Facebook, they earn their money from us. I mean, they gain money from us using their services. We don't pay for it, but we kind of pay with our by providing them with data. And if we say, well, if we're going to give you this data about ourselves, it has to be secure at least. I mean, then that actually applies a certain kind of pressure to them. So
it does. And I would go so far as to say that another form of, that's something else that we should demand to apply pressure for them. And this is something that Facebook is notoriously not paying any attention to, is if we do decide to pull up our tent stakes and move elsewhere and delete our accounts, our data should be, in fact, deleted.
Yes.
No sneaky tricks with if you go to, involving going to a web page somewhere that happens to have a Facebook beacon, and by going to that page and hitting the beacon, the Facebook account you thought you deleted is going to stay around for another week, and or actually deleting the pictures you put up when you tell them to delete it.
Indeed. And I think that this is another crucial security issues with the social media, that once you have a Facebook account and once you log in and you don't log out properly, everything that has one of these small scripts, the same goes for Google and Google Analytics, these corporations can actually keep track of you on most pages on the internet. So it's I think it's underestimated as a security threat what these beacons and what these kind of scripts actually do to mapping your online behavior. And I mean, the way I see it, it's okay if you're aware of it. It's okay as a business model. But the thing is that there are many pages that are supposed to kind of promote online activism, to spread news about politics and so on. And what these sites do is to put a Facebook button, a Twitter button, a Google button, and whatever. They kind of put all the scripts that they have onto this page without knowing that these scripts actually are the the prime or the most effective way of actually mapping who is visiting a certain page and so forth. So I think that also people outside, I mean, small actors, people who are setting up web pages need to be aware that putting a Facebook button on your page means that you are sending a message back to Facebook that somebody has visited your page. And are you really kind of comfortable with that data being sent to Facebook every time somebody visits your web page? So I think that kind of bringing about an awareness about how the web is actually interconnected and how data is gathered and sent back and forth around the world is really important.
It is, yes. You're right. A lot of people don't realize exactly how much is going on inside their browser without their knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The sheer amount of snippets of JavaScript going around, which hit Google Analytics or one of the 400, 500, I don't know exactly how many there are these days, web traffic analysis companies is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yeah. So, summing up this discussion, we have to kind of work to explain better to the world how to use these technologies, how to kind of use them in your everyday life. But also we have to put pressure on the big actors, such as Facebook, Google, Twitter, and all the kind of major players in the social media kind of economies. And we have to be aware of every little snippet of code that we put on our own web pages and kind of think and reflect on how these technologies work and where data is actually being shipped around the world. So with that said, I thank you very much, the doctor, and it was nice talking to you, and I think that we had a few good insights to send out to the world.
It was good to talk to you too. Thank you for having me on.